Good morning, everybody, or good afternoon, rather. How's everybody doing? Good? All right, great. Thank you for joining me for the lightning talks. We have a record number of talks. Who in the room is presenting today? Okay, good. So if you're presenting, make sure to come up front. My lightning talk is first, and then do we have Dan with the Lanny file system? Okay, good. You're on deck right after me. So are we ready to go? Okay, cool. First up is me, and I'm going to just very briefly give you an overview of how this works, how to give a good lightning talk. Like I just said, be close to the stage when it's time to present. What I'm going to do between each talk is I'm going to say what talk is next and then the talk after that. So if you're the talk after the talk that's going on, that's your cue to come up to the front and be ready to jump right up to the podium. All the slides run off of this laptop. So when you want to switch slides, all you have to do is say slide and the next slide will go on. Even though you only have 5 minutes for your lightning talk, be sure to stay calm, relaxed. There's always a tendency to rush and say everything really, really fast when you're, because you only have 5 minutes and everything's good, but just relax. It's fine. Just speak clearly, get your point across as succinctly as possible, and everything will be good. Slide. Probably not a great idea to read what's on your slides because most of the people, how many people in the room can read? Okay, I'm only getting about half. I guess it's a little bit early. People lose their literacy skills without coffee, I suppose. Slide. If you have any questions during your talk, the tendency for most people is to finish right around 3.5 minutes or 4 minutes. And so when that happens, some people might ask a question. Because we don't really have time in this session for an audio angel to head over and ask the question, try to listen and be sure to repeat the question so that not only everybody in the room hears it, but all of the people watching the streams can hear it as well. And also don't forget when you're done, since during this session it's pretty typical for people to be coming in and out of the room, be sure to reintroduce yourself at the end of your talk and briefly say what the project was and where people can find you. Most people have that in their final slide, but just in case, it's a good thing to say that in case the people on the stream switch away. And when all talks, if they haven't finished up by 4 minutes, will get a 1 minute warning. I will just come on the microphone and say 1 minute, and then 30 seconds. But when it's time for a person to wrap up, I will go like this, and then you guys know what to do at this point.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All right, let's practice the buzzer sound just one more time real quick from three. So ready?
10, 2, 1.
And obviously when that happens, your time is over. So let's have lots of fun. And if we actually still have some open sessions in this first round of lightning talks, but don't forget we'll also have lightning talks on day 3 and 4. And we need more Pecha Kucha slides for presentations. That's 20 slides, 20 seconds per slide, and they advance automatically. And that session is always a lot of fun. So without any further ado, Dan, are you ready to go?
Yep.
Okay, cool.
One question.
Oh, we have one question.
What happened to the extra minute with the applause?
People complained about that. It got a little complicated. I obviously didn't have my coffee or my little break before this. The question was, what happened to the 4 minute extra minute rule? What we used to do is at 4 minutes, I would ask the audience for a round of applause to see if the presenter deserved an extra minute. And for maybe about a quarter of the audience, a lot of the feedback from previous years was that that system was a little confusing. So I decided to just go ahead and get rid of it since it didn't come into play that often. But If you'd like, you can always leave feedback in Pentabarf and have me bring it back, if you'd like. So without any further ado, Dan, are you ready to go?
Yes, let's start. Thank you, Nick.
Okay, go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Good news, there's another file system, if we hadn't enough yet. My name is Dan, I'm from CCC Munich, and the file system I'm presenting is LennyFS. It's my master's thesis project. So slide. What's LennyFS? The Lanyard file system, short LennyFS, was designed for removable storage devices, particularly those small gadgets one would carry around using a lanyard, like this one. So why another? Because I had some problems with the current file systems. Slide, please. I have a challenge for you. Store an 8 GB HD movie file on a removable storage device, plug the device into your multimedia TV, and open the file for watching. Which file system would you use? And I ran into a problem when I tried this. So the question is to ask, is the file system supported by the computer for reading and writing? Is it supported by the TV for reading? Does it support file sizes over 4 GB, like one does not? How would you avoid file ownership problems? And if you have ownerships and permission, which permissions would you set for user group and others? And you run into compatibility issues eventually. Slide. Because file systems are either easy to implement, free of weird licensing, or widely deployed, but you cannot have all of them. Slide. So LennyFS is a file system designed from scratch with the following design principles. And the first one is simplicity. Avoid complexity whenever it is possible. And we ask ourselves, would a drunk monkey be able to implement this? And if so, it's good. Interoperability. We provide the minimum consensus of file systems, and we drop OS-specific features. And flexibility, because we're targeting the embedded sector. We format small flash cells as well as multi-terabyte external hard drives, like you need for the FTPs here. Slide. Next, LennyFS comes with a bunch of features. We have rooted binary trees for fast searching. We count the writes on blocks. We have block addresses of variable length, different block sizes. We store creation and modification time and some optional attributes we call flags. Slide. It has more features. It lacks of access times because nobody uses them. On removable storage, distinction between change and modification time. We have no ownership information, no control list, and no traditional Unix permissions. And I think this is a list of features because I don't use them on removable storage devices. Slide. In Unix, everything is a file, and in LennyFS, everything is a block. And we have different types of blocks, each block specialized for a particular use case. Slide. To bring the system to life, we link those blocks together. And by doing so, we put logic into the whole file system, representing the structure of the data. For example, the super block, which is the first block ever read, points to the root directory so you can list the files inside the directory. Slide. What we have done so far, we have an experimental Linux driver working. A FreeBSD driver is currently being worked on. And we have a lot of work for interested developers. So if you have time and no project, the Congress, join the development. Slide. Get involved. You can meet me at the Munich CCC Assembly at OXOA. Have a look at the webpage. We have a lot of documentation there. You can download the whole thesis document and join the development. Thank you very much.
All right, most excellent. Came in just a little bit under time. For everybody, you might be familiar with this role of mine. For everybody who's clustered up there, we have plenty of free seats over here. Just for old time's sake, will all you guys over there with a free seat raise your hand? Plenty of free seats over here, so you can go ahead and make your way right over there. And are we ready?
I'm ready.
We're ready to go? Okay, so let's just jump right into the next presentation, and your 5 minutes starts now.
Okay, hi everyone. My name is Ralph. I'm from Technische Universität München. Slide, please. Last year here, or rather in Berlin, we introduced Crossbear, our tool for localizing and detecting man-in-the-middle attacks on SSL, which uses a notary principle plus a hunting. And I'm briefly going to explain now. Slide, please. The idea is you've got a user Alice, it's always Alice, and Alice accesses a host, slide please, and she's got a man in the middle, evil guy, slide. So what she does is she asks our server, can you please check the fingerprint or certificate of this other server for me please, slide. Our server is willing to oblige, and slide please. And it's going to report the result, slide. What we do now is the hunting. We send our report together with a trace route to the server, slide. Yep, that's sending to the server, slide please. And the server compiles a list of hunting tasks, which essentially is a request to help out, slide please. So some user Bob, that's not a hacker, or maybe it is. But yeah, Bob goes hunting, does the SSL handshake or whatever, and does a trace route, slide, and reports too. And the clue is now, slide please, there are many Bobs. Right? And the idea here is that we can that we can get a good idea where the attacker is located in the network from having many trace routes. Slide. So what we have done so far was this, and today I'm going to talk about SSH because we have implemented the SSH fingerprinting checks now. For example, this morning I had to connect to my server and didn't know the host key fingerprint. So I could use our shiny new notary, which you see here as the host name. And that's based on IPv4 wide SSH scans plus live checks. Slides, please. We have a proof of concept implementation, which I hope to be able to publish around January or February. Essentially, it's a patch for OpenSSH. You can use it to do a live check with our server, as I have shown you. And OpenSSH is going to warn on a mismatch. We still have to do the trace routing part because it's a bit more complicated for OpenSSH. If you don't want to use our notary, fine. Grab the software, set up your own. Slide, please. Or if it can't be bothered at all, just use the tool DIG or really any DNS tool that you want because you can query the results from our IPv4 wide scan of port 22, which I might say was a lot of fun. That's the answer section. That's the result you get, a fingerprint, and when we have seen it the last time, plus some SSH information. So yeah, we are around. Slide, please. If you have questions, we are here at the Peer-to-Peer Hackers Assembly. There's a longer talk on day 4, and we can be reached on Twitter, and of course we have a homepage, and our software is on GitHub. I believe that's all from me so far, so thank you for listening.
All right, most excellent. Everybody who is over there, we've got plenty of seats waiting for you on this side of the room. Come on in, make some friends. Hex F, with the door lock, you're up. Wonderful mask. Yes, I was just going to do that. World Vibe, you are right up after this lovely talk on electronic door locks. So up next is World Vibe, and then after that, Matthias. Both you guys in the room? Ready to go? Okay, great. So that clocked in under, and we are actually right about on time. Are you ready to go?
Yes.
Take it away.
Okay, if you stayed in a hotel, you've probably seen a lock very much like this. It's quite common and it's used all over the world. Slide. Last August, Cody Brocious revealed the flaw in the system. He spent about 3 years full-time reverse engineering the entire system. He's a lot of stuff up on his website. So what I'm basically going to do is a workshop using the information he has and explain about the Onity HT lock system. So there's 4 million locks. They reckon in some areas about a third of the hotels that use electronic locking systems use this very system. It's been out since 1993. There is a few different models, but most of them work all the same way. So the workshop I'm doing is on day 4 at 2 o'clock in Hall 13. Slide. So what the workshop we're going to be doing is building a working opener from a kit. So this is my little device here. I don't know if we can put up on the screen a bit of video from the camera. I don't know if that's possible.
It's not possible, I'm sorry.
Okay. Anyway, it's a small little kit designed to be really easy to build, and it basically does its job opening the lock. So, as well as in the workshop, the kit is only a small part of the workshop. We're going to discuss how the kit works and what it actually does to communicate with the lock, because the lock has encryption on it, and there's encryption used in the cards, so it's not a simple matter of just asking the lock to open. Identifying which model lock is which, there's a lot of locks and different manufacturers' ones look similar, so trying to identify if the hotel you're staying in has the actual lock we're interested in. Discussing mitigation techniques, basically the manufacturers of the lock have said they're going to try prevent this from happening, so what have they done and what they're going to do next. And next steps, future projects. So the primary components of the system is an encoder. That's at reception, it makes the cards, and it loads data into a portable programmer. So you carry the portable programmer to the door, and using that, you program the lock. So the lock we're talking about is a standard guest room locks. So slide. So what I'll show you here is if an invalid card is inserted, you stick it in the top, pull it out, you should get a little red light. And then if a valid card is inserted, if I can do this right, you get a little green lock and the door opens. But that's when you have a room key. Obviously, we don't like using room keys, so we plug this into the bottom, press the button, and within a second or two, it opens the lock. And it does that for all the locks. More importantly, it gets information from the lock, such as the site code. You can program master cards to open all the locks in all the hotels. So the details are there, day 4. The kits are €20, but if you don't want to buy one on the day, you don't have to buy one. I'll still show you, and we can still discuss how it works and so on. Okay, any questions? Yeah, sorry, go.
Did you try it in the Radisson Hotel or there?
I didn't try it, but someone said it's a different system in the Radisson. I can't afford to stay there, unfortunately. But I have tried it in real hotels, and it does work. Sorry, one more.
Is it available at the Dominic
Strauss-Kahn? be sure to repeat the question.
Yeah, sorry. The question was, is it available to Dominic Strauss-Kahn? Well, one of the reasons the guy released this was saying that information, what time the door was opened, who opened the door, was it the guest, was it the cleaner, has been used in court cases, and like in murder trials mainly. So,
if, 1 minute.
Yeah, if, like I'm saying, if that had came to court, that case, potentially the information could be used. And obviously, when you understand the system, you understand that all that information can be faked. Okay, any more questions? Okay, I think that's about it.
All right, that was great. We have not yet had a countdown this morning. Just as another reminder to everybody who is just joining us this morning, I think, do we still have free spaces over there? Yep, you can see all of the hands raised in the audience. You have plenty of free spaces. Please help find a seat, come on into the room, and let other people cluster up and stand by the door. All right, so we have not yet had a countdown. We're doing pretty good on time. Got your updated slides ready to go. And if you are ready, I'm ready. We all good?
I'm ready,
your
yeah.
5 minutes starts now.
Okay, I'm Hyga, and I will tell you about a worldwide project. So this started about a year ago. Slide. So three guys, me, the physicist, an aerospace engineer, and a mechanical engineer, were sitting around on a couch, drinking beer, chatting, thinking about stuff we did. And we all know each other from the Formula Student Competition. This is a competition between universities making a race car. So we were hanging around, season finished, not knowing what to do next. Slide. So we were thinking about life, and it was like, we need money, yeah? And the other one wanted to make some vacation, and the man in the middle was getting short messages from his girlfriend, and it was like annoying how often he got SMS. And then he was saying something like, it would be fucking awesome to satisfy my girl remotely. Slide. Okay, sex sells. Yeah. Okay, sex sells, but the idea was, for sure someone did this already. Slide. So Google knows everything. We were checking the market and wanted to buy something like this. Yeah? And then we found the solution on the left on top. This is something like, I think you have to plug in a USB wire and you need a laptop and, okay, not so nice. The other one is even worse. It's like you have to put a power plug and you need a PC workstation with the RS-232 and it's like, it's more like a driller, yeah? Okay, so slide. So don't panic, yeah, was my first idea because, look, we have everything we need. Huh? We have smartphones, we have three software, we have some a nice Bluetooth module. This is the BTM-182 from Razer, I think it is. So I will tell about this later. And there are Chinese suppliers which make prototypes for no money and send it to you within 2 days. Huh? And so I decided we can make this. Huh? Slide. So this is the general idea how it works. Yeah? First is there's only the vibrator. The vibrator has a button, so you can use it just traditionally. Yeah. Okay, boring. Yeah, boring. Then imagine only she wants to use the vibrator in a more fancy way. So she has a Bluetooth connection to the vibrator, and she can make some programs and yeah. Imagine. Yes, she can use her phone to control the vibrator. Yeah? But this is not enough. Yeah? It has to be more fancy because we do fancy stuff. Yeah? So she can give a call or he can call her via voice over IP technology, everything free. And then she can both can have a live video streaming from each other. So it's more like amateur YouTube. Yeah? And you porn maybe. And on top, the control is on his phone. So he makes plus, minus, and then the vibrator is working on this level. Yeah? So in fact, everything is working. Yeah. Next slide. So I will give a short technical rainbow. It's really easy, huh? Because in fact, the main components are only the tiny, ATtiny 2313. The reason for this is only that it is a chip with two PWMs, yeah? So PWMs for the two motors. So there's one motor in the front and one motor in the rear. And then there's the battery, nothing weird. And then there's the Bluetooth module. Yeah. So this Bluetooth module is really simple. It's like an UART extension to Bluetooth. Yeah. It's really like using a serial port. Yeah. Slide. Then, of course, there's Android app. There's an Android app. Yeah. So you have a single mode and a live partner mode. Single mode I will present now. So, okay, so maybe.
Okay. 30 seconds.
Okay, for live video chat, there's no girl next year, so next time maybe, slide. So we want to make an iPhone app too, but Apple is more problematic for this. Yeah? And then there's a multi-touch control, like gestures on the multi-touch screen, voice control, and music control, so for the beats. Slide.
Well, I guess that's not the kind of lightning talk that you get every day. So, everybody who's clustered up in the back, do we still have seats over here? Okay, oh, we still have seats all the way. Oh, and up front, right down there, make friends. So, Alrighty, Matthias, you are up on deck. Thomas, you are right after this. And Padaloon and Breno, you are two talks away. So you good? Okay, great. So without any further ado, doing great on time. You ready to go?
Yeah.
Your five-minute starts now.
So, hello everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here today. My name is Matthias and I'm a member of the GNUNet project, and today I'm giving you a short introduction into the GNU Alternative Domain Name System, which is going to be a completely decentralized and secure alternative to DNS. Slide, please. So, today, many different parties have interest in controlling what content you can see on the internet. And it's quite easy to remove content from the internet by just making the domain names not accessible anymore. Slide, please. So DNS is decentralized, okay, but on the other hand, it has a hierarchical structure. So if you control one of the zones, or you control one of the companies controlling the zones, it's quite easy for you to remove domain names, and so just make the content not accessible anymore. Slide, please. So for GUTS, we use insightful hypothesis on the construction of naming systems. It's called Suku's triangle, and Suku's triangle states that names in a name system can have three different properties. So they can be secure, memorable, or globally unique. But a name system cannot fulfill all three properties at the same time. So for DNS, you have global unique and memorable names, and they try to go in the secure direction by adding features like DNSSEC. So for GUTS, we decided to emphasize the secure and memorable properties, and so GUTS falls into the category of a pet name system. A pet name system, you know, from instant messaging applications. So there you have like a buddy list, and every user has a cryptic, globally unique ID. And when you add them, you assign them a nickname. So that's basically a pet name system. In GUTS, every user controls his own zone. And slide, please. So here we have Alice. Alice is a GUTS user, and Alice has her local zone, which is identified by a public key and a private key. To this zone, she adds all the required resource records, like for her web server or her mail server. Alice is a GUTS user, and she went to Hamburg to this Congress. And there, after the talk, she meets Bob. Bob is also a GUTS user. And Bob gave her his business card with this public key in the form of a QR code on it. And so Alice could add Bob's public key to her local zone. And now Alice is able to resolve Bob's name. So, slide, please. In GUTS, transitivity is a very important aspect for names. So here we have Alice. Alice now knows Bob under the name Bob. And Bob knows a guy called Dave, to which he refers as Buddy. And with transitivity of names, Alice is now able to resolve Dave's records by using the name buddy.bob.gets. Slide, please. So, the name resolution in GUTS works the way. So, Alice met Bob, and now she's interested in looking at his website. And so she types the address of his website in his browser. So the browser asked the local GUTS resolver to resolve www.bob.gets. And since they met before, and Alice added Bob's public key to her local zone, the GUTS resolver can get Bob's
1 minute.
Bob's public key from the local name store. He then combines the desired name, www, with the public key. And since Bob is a GUTS user, he stored his records in the DHT. And the GUTS resolver can retrieve the A and quad A records from DHT, and so Alice can have a look at Bob's website and contact him. Slide, please. So this was just a very brief introduction. There are quite some issues to solve.
30 seconds.
If you want to integrate it with legacy applications like web serving, secure web serving, or email. So if you are interested, you can find us at the Peer-to-Peer Hackers Assembly. And have a look at our website. There you can download more information. Thank you very much.
I love a good countdown, don't you guys? All right. So right now we have Project FPGA 68K, then Padaloon, you're up after that, and on deck right after that, Big Alex. Are you in the room? Big Alex? Okay, awesome, great. So we've got our next speakers up. You ready to go?
Yes, I am.
Okay, your 5 minutes starts now.
Hello, everybody. My name is Thomas Tazimbay, and I want to present one of my latest hardware developments. It's a small and cheap FPGA evaluation board. Next slide, please. A couple of months ago, I started to develop my own FPGA evaluation board with many simple interfaces on board that can be used easily, even by beginners. This board uses a modern Spartan 6 LX9 FPGA that can be supported by an external 68K CPU. The board can be built at home, but you should have done soldering fine pitch SMD before. Next slide, please. Here we have an overview of the board. The board has a standard VGA output. 12 bits are used for over 4,000 colors. It has a 9-pin joystick connector, according to the old Atari standard. Next to the joystick port, a mini DIN connector is located in case a PS2 mouse or a keyboard shall be connected. Two independent serial ports, one according to the RS-232 standard. The other one is implemented as a USB port in slave mode. Furthermore, we have a static RAM connected directly to the FPGA. And I already mentioned the 68000 CPU that is also connected to the FPGA and to the RAM. The FPGA is clocked by an oscillator mounted on the bottom side of the PCB. The user interface of the board features 8 LEDs, 8 7-segment displays, 8 switches, and 8 push buttons. Next slide, please. All the displays, the LEDs, the switches, and push buttons are connected to the FPGA via a display driver that takes care of the LED multiplexing and the scanning of the switches. The display driver itself is controlled by SPI. The programming of the FPGA takes place by a 6-pin JTAG header. And for non-volatile storage, a serial flash is foreseen. Next slide, please. For your own extensions, there's a 40-pin extension header that can be used to connect your own circuits. Here you find 10 unused FPGA pins. Additional LEDs and 7-segment displays can also be connected here directly to the display driver. Next slide. The board itself is a two-layer PCB with components on both sides. PCB size is 160 millimeter by 100 millimeter. To power the board, a stabilized 5-volt, 2-amp power supply is necessary. Next slide, please. The status so far. VGA, serial ports, joystick interface, and the displays and switches have been tested and are working properly. The mouse and keyboard interface, the RAM and the CPU are next on the list and will be tested within the next few weeks. And up to now, I haven't had time for the website too. Next slide, please. Yeah, next steps. Finishing the tests and writing of a few Hello World designs. Launching the website fpga68k.de. And finding of a few people willing to build this board. The cost for it would be approximately 120 euros. And as you can see here, your help in any way would be very much appreciated. Next slide, please. So, would you like to participate? Maybe you need more information. Maybe you are interested in building this board, or would you like to talk to me about it? Then, next slide. Then please contact me. My name is Thomas Tazimwe. This is my telephone number here at the Congress. This is my email address. Thank you very much for listening. Yes, of course.
Is this FPGA something you could use for, you know, fast processing of breaking keys or something like that? How fast?
Repeat the question.
I repeat the question. He's asking how fast the FPGA is. Up to now, a 25 megahertz oscillator is clocking the FPGA, but there's a PLL on the FPGA that can multiply the clock. Up to 100 megahertz, for example, but it's it depends on your design how fast the design can be clocked.
Great, thank you. And up next we have Brenno and Padaloon. Didn't get slides in, but they're going to go ahead and give a lightning talk without slides. Just two quick reminders: we still have some open slots for today and plenty of open slots on day and 3 and 4. And do we still have some seats over here? Yep, everybody who is clustered by the door, if you'd like to take a seat, we have plenty of seats, clear aisleways all throughout here. So come on in, make friends with your neighbors, and are you ready to go?
Yes.
You good? Okay, your 5 minutes starts now.
Yeah. Hello, my name is Padaloon. I'm from the wonderful NGO,
Louder.
I hear me wonderful, okay. My name is Padaloon. I am from the wonderful NGO Digital Courage, and formerly known as FÖBUD. And 7 years ago, I built up in the FÖBUD an online shop. And since this time, I always thought, many people ask me for my passport, perhaps I want a telephone or a Bahn card for a half price ticket for the railways here in Germany, or I want to take a flight. And they always ask me for my ID card, for my official ID card. And I look into the Personalausweisgesetz and I see they don't have to ask me, but they do. And so I thought, okay, I should make my own passports, my own ID cards. And so perhaps most of you have seen it near the wardrobe. I settled up a stand where you can take a photo and we can make your ID card a non-official ID card, nicht amtlicher Lichtbildausweis. You should have two of them, one with your personal data. You can use it wherever you want, and one with fake data. Yeah, we write everything in you want. You can just get it, €15. Okay, it's not an advertisement, but it's very funny and it's very amazing. And yeah, this year we got an information from our famous customer, Brenno de Winter, and he did wonderful stuff with this ID cards. One sentence before, I traveled by airplane in South Africa, in Finland, in Germany. Everybody accepts these cards. And and our wonderful, famous customer, Brenno de Winter, made a lot more funny stuff with it.
Hi, and before you forget to tell, at 8:30 we give a workshop on how to use the card and the privacy aspects of it. But I started to use it after CCC on the way back in the train. They wanted to see my ID card, so I showed my Lichtbildausweis. And since I'm an investigative journalist, I thought like, okay, let's investigate this and try to use it wherever I can. So I was able to enter all the ministries when I had an appointment. Even though since 1945 the Germans are not ruling our country anymore, I could vote with my Lichtbildausweis. The Dutch Secret Service took my card to inspect all the details and then gave it back and accepted it. And since I was last year named Journalist of the Year, I was invited at a banquet at Royal Palace. And there was only one check they had to do to make sure that they had the right person meeting the Queen. But I have to be honest, they checked it twice. Conclusion is the thing worked. A couple of weeks ago, the prince was speaking at an engagement, and two of the security guys came to me like, "Hey, how are you doing?" and stuff. And they said like, "You have to show ID again, but this time your Lichtbildausweis won't work." So I went like, "You want to bet?" So I took my Lichtbildausweis, and when I walked in the building, I only did. And it still works. And when I checked in, when I checked in the hotel in Hamburg a couple of days ago, of course, they took my Lichtbildausweis like I was a German person. So I've got multiple identities, and at 8:30 we'll tell you a lot more about it. So please come to the workshop in Saal 12, glaube ich. Yeah, 12. So just make sure you'll be there, and we'll have some fun.
Most excellent. Another reminder, if all of you guys who are back there, that we still have open seats over here. We're running a little bit behind schedule, but I think we'll catch up. Big Alex, are you Big Alex or Seb?
Yeah.
Okay, you ready to go? Your 5 minutes starts now.
Thank you very much, Nick Ferrer, for that nice introduction, and thank you for your time to listening. And I want to use the next 4 minutes and 50 seconds to excite you for two projects we brought along from Dresden, the Pentabag and our PentaArm board. Next slide, please. The Pentabag is basically a very nice introductory project to microcontrollers, just like the Arduino boards, for instance. It's basically a battery-powered Atmel processor with some LEDs and some switches. And to make this thing shake, rattle, and move and make it interesting for kids or for beginners, it has a piezo buzzer to beep around and a vibration motor to make it move. So we did an extensive DARPA-sponsored studies on robotic vibration-powered motion to make this move along. And furthermore, it has, of course, an ISP and an USART connector and some extension connectors. And we designed this as an introductory project for our Datenspuren conference we have annually at Dresden for the young and up-and-coming hackers track. So it's designed for kids, but we found out the adults like it very much, and they are very keen on them to build them because it's just fun to have something that shakes and beeps and does strange stuff. Next slide, please. And why do we think this is a nice project for beginners? The first point, it's very easy to solder. It's amazing what 10-year-old kids can solder, and they successfully build these boards. It's sometimes a bit dangerous because they talk to you and wave around the soldering iron in the other direction. John had a very nice experience in some burnt hair, but this was the worst thing that happened. And it's very cheap. You can do it for whole classes in school. It's just about 8 to 10 euros for all the parts. And it's very easy to start programming with because you just need 5 or 10 lines of codes to make an LED blink or to make it beep or to make it rattle. But it wouldn't be a nice project if you couldn't continue, because with some hacking, you can do a lot of more stuff. You can write very sophisticated code with it. You can, for instance, use a buzzer as a microphone. It's just a piezo buzzer, and you can detect the body sound. If you put it on a table and knock on it, then it can detect the sound and move along, for instance. or you can use, this is very well known to most hackers, LEDs as light sensors. But if you show it to kids that LEDs can not only emit light, but only also measure light, this is a very interesting fun fact for Hackett, and you can experiment with a lot of other stuff with serial communication and 2-bit. One of our hackers did a 2-channel sound synthesis with this piezo buzzer, so you can do quite advanced projects. Next slide, please. If this is not enough for you, if you crave for more, Seb has brought along his PentaArm small arm development board. Just a very tiny stem-sized board with an ARM Cortex-M3 microprocessor, and it's quite easy to solder. It takes a bit of luck, and it's a bit fiddly because you have very small components on it, but with a little help, everyone managed to solder, even SMT soldering beginners. So if you want to get started with ARM development and with SMT soldering, just come around to our place in the Hack Center here, just right there. Next slide, please. And meet us at the hardware hacking area. We will have some set some soldering stations up. And tomorrow there will also be a special track for young hackers. I'm told it's in the speakers' corners from noon on. I don't know where it is, but I'm make sure you will find it. Or just come around at our desk at the hardware hacking area beneath Mitch Altman and ask us. And we have some kids with us and talk to us. And thank you very much for listening. And just come around. Thank you.
All right, Rainier's up next.
Yeah. What a big audience. Okay, I'm Rainier Barkels. I have to make a warning first. This is, there have been lots of funny stories. This is not a funny story. This is a very serious thing, a dreadful story, actually. Can you show the full? F5.
Yeah, it shows up on here, but not over there. That's the problem.
Okay.
If worse comes to worse, we just bail and go to the PDFs like everybody else.
Okay.
See, let me.
You offered me a choice.
I did, and I clearly overreached. Okay. Let's see if we can.
Well, let me start talking. You probably read in the newspapers in the past weeks and months about patent wars, especially between smart telephone manufacturers. And well, there are lots of these charts. I actually chose the most colorful chart I could find on the internet and put it on my slide, but there are other ones as well. I'm not going to explain all the errors because time doesn't allow. These smartphone patent wars. What's going on? Is it perhaps miserable Korean manufacturers who are trying to imitate the brilliant inventions that Steve Jobs made? Oh, there we are.
I haven't even actually started your 5 minutes yet, so.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Is this about Korean imitators of Steve Jobs' brilliant inventions? Well, actually, it isn't, and I'm going to explain on the next slide, please. How does this work? There is a game which is, well, a very serious game, which is actually called strategic patenting. And how does it work? You must, as a manufacturer, try to get a zillion trivial patents, not just for your product, as it says, but in general. For instance, for that reason, Google bought Motorola just to get an enormous amount of patents. And then you're pretty sure that your competitor will infringe. But your competitor will not even try not to infringe because it's not doable, because he can't check a zillion patents. So, but still, this is not a situation where you can easily sue your competitor because he will have prepared a defensive patent portfolio, again, with lots and lots of patents. And in that kind of situation, the net effect is it's actually, there's a nice literature, a law and economics literature, and especially American, and it says that it's all military jargon you read there. It leads to an arms race, and it, which leads to the prospect of mutual destruction. The older people in the room may remember the term from the days of the Cold War, when nuclear missiles were supposed to provide a threat of mutual destruction, so that nobody dared to attack the other one. But and if it happens like that, then there is no effect to innovation whatsoever. Actually, I found some literature which actually says that the firms are really getting patents to provide design freedom. It's a matter of so it doesn't contribute at all to innovation. It's just a matter of regaining the freedom they used to have. But it used to work in past times when, but now recently the fights are getting more grim, as you have noticed in the newspapers. And actually, the deterrent effect of mutual destruction does not work anymore, because you have seen that particularly Apple is suing Samsung. Slide, please. Now, these things are particularly American. In America, there's a long tradition of patent wars, which actually goes back over two centuries. But this thing is getting contagious and will probably spread to Europe. How does it work? In Europe, there's still patent infringement cases have to be brought for individual courts. In Germany, it's the Bundespatentgericht, and then in Netherlands, it's in The Hague, and so on. But now, there has been talk for about 30 years for a unified patent court, and now the preparations are in the final stage. Van Rompuy, he decided this is an ambitious project. He started to work on it, and it's in its final stage. The purpose is to simplify things and to reduce costs, but actually it's very complicated and probably prohibitively expensive for small and medium enterprises, who are more important in Europe than in the US, for instance. And it will not, the thought would of course be it fosters EU competitiveness, but actually it doesn't. But as the small graph shows, that the dark blue part is
1 minute.
Oops. The dark blue part is the number of patents owned by Europeans. So it's really effectively it provides a one-stop shopping for the US to extend their patent wars to Europe. And it will probably be meant by judges who believe in patents. In the U.S., they have a court, a special patent court, which is all in front of patents. Well,
30 seconds.
Slide. Okay, next slide. Okay, this is the old slide. I provided the new one. How can we fight this unified patent court? It has been decided. You have probably may have read in newspapers, but there is work on the way, and there is actually a URL which is supposed to be there, who says 6, 5, 4. Get in touch with me if you need to, Uriel.
All right, I apologize for that one. There's always one presentation that goes a little awry. Also, one quick reminder, when you are up and speaking, I know it's always tempting to try to go off and look at your slides, but when you go off and look at your slides, people can't hear you in the microphone, just like I'm going like this. So the best thing to do is to speak into the microphone, and if you need to look at your slide, you can always turn into your microphone and do that. So Wendy is up next. She has updated slides, which I'm going to try to pull up right now. Does this look good?
That looks great.
Okay.
All right. So Wendy Seltzer here to talk with you about the Chilling Effects Clearinghouse and data that we've been gathering in the 10 years that we've been in existence, and the most recent year to date. Chilling Effects catalogs information on notice and takedown of websites and threats to free expression online. So next slide, please. There's our website, chillingeffects.org. Next slide. If you may have gotten to that site doing a search on Google and get to the bottom of the search, and in response to a complaint we received under the U.S. Digital Millennium Copyright Act, we've removed a result from this page. If you wish, you may read the DMCA complaint. That link goes to the Chilling Effects website. Next slide, please. So on Chilling Effects, we get all of the complaints that Google receives, all of the complaints that Twitter receives. This graph is log scale. In the last year, we've received more complaints than the previous 9 years by an order of magnitude. 53 million URLs demanded to be taken down and counting. The year isn't done yet. That's compared with 3 million in 2011. URL requests to Google. That yellow line underneath, Google has recently started publishing in their transparency report URLs that they didn't remove because the complaints were bogus or badly formed or misidentified material. Next slide, please. So some, like this was a URL asked to be removed. This is Twilight Eclipse, the movie. Oh, wait, but it's not. too cloudy to see the eclipse. In Seattle, the firm Yes It Is, next slide. Yes It Is, no piracy. I asked for thousands of URLs to be removed, apparently by doing searches on things like download Eclipse, see Eclipse online, and Google disregarded those. Next slide, please. Another one. Microsoft, through the firm Leak ID, identified this as a source of downloads of Windows 8. Of course, this is an Ars Technica article talking about the product, probably trying to encourage people to buy it rather than download. Next slide. So who sends these complaints to Google? We've got about 14% of the complaints come in from the U.S. recording industry. That's about 7 million URLs. Next after them are porn, Microsoft, music from the British phonographic industry, TV, movies, porn, TV, anime, porn, movies, porn, 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 porn. Next slide, please. We've also seen the rise of a bunch of entities serving as complainant services firms. Degban services complaints on behalf of porn companies. Recording industry, BPI, Takedown, piracy, mostly porn. DetectNet, Fox Group, NBC Universal. Next slide, please. We also get complaints from Twitter. Twitter gives us both the copyright complaints and the content removal demands. If you're here in Germany doing a search and looking for the Hanover Ticker Twitter account, you'll get this notice that content has been removed in Germany. Learn more, next slide. You'll see information about country withheld content and Twitter's policy on that, next slide. You see also instructions on how to tell Twitter if you've been identified as in the wrong country, if their IP geolocation worked wrong. You can change that. Next slide, please. Or you can use something like Tor and come out in a different country and visit the content anyhow. Next slide, please. And then you can visit Chilling Effects and see the complaints received. That was a pro-Nazi site removed for violating laws here. Next slide, please. So if you're interested in using data, helping us to do better visualizations than these, combing through that and finding out other interesting trends in the year in DMCA takedowns, you can follow us on Twitter, you can visit the website, or please get in touch. Thank you.
Wendy, honestly, when you handed me last minute slides, I was not expecting at some point in the presentation for you to be going porn, porn, porn. But thank you very much. Another round of applause for Wendy. That was a really awesome high energy presentation. All right. And up next, I thought I knew what we had up next. Okay, Ernesto, and you sent me, let's just double check since these were... This was a last-minute slide ad. do a quick preview. Is this correct?
It's just a PDF, but I will switch to German because I'm not that used to English in this topic.
Okay, well, what's the word for slide in German?
For, yeah.
I think I can do that. Do you think I can handle that?
There are quite a lot of slides, so okay. I will just say next.
Sounds good. All right, your 5 minutes starts now.
Okay, ich bin Ernest Ruge. Ich wollte über ein Thema sprechen, was ein bisschen abseits ist, aber doch sehr viel mit diesem Kongress zu tun hat, nämlich Open Traffic, Mobilitätskonzepte, offene Daten und die daraus folgenden Sicherheitsalbträume, die dort so entstehen. Next. Normalerweise geht man einen Weg, indem man von A nach B geht. Next. Das geht meistens über irgendwelche Umwege, X oder Y. Next. Man legt diese für gewöhnlich mit einem Auto heutzutage noch zurück oder next mit dem ÖPNV. In moderneren Systemen next kann man dann auch schon intermodale Systeme nutzen, das heißt ein Auto, ein Carsharing-Fahrzeug mit integrieren in den Weg, next. Das geht im Moment noch über verschiedenste Ticketing-Systeme wie zum Beispiel Papier oder eben irgendwelche Member-Cards, next. Und da kommen wir auch gleich zu dem ersten, das ist das E-Ticket, welches dann garantieren soll, dass man mit einem einzigen Ticket von A nach B kommt. Komme ich gleich noch darauf zu sprechen. Next. Außerdem gibt es natürlich noch den Aspekt Routing, dass man über Z vielleicht eventuell viel besser kommt. Next. Und eventuell auch ein anderes Verkehrsmittel nutzt, wie beispielsweise das Fahrrad und vielleicht auf den verschiedenen Strecken auch andere Verkehrsmittel. Next. Ja, perfekt. Nein, next. Das ist ein Beispiel, da soll ich zum Beispiel 30 Minuten zu Fuß gehen. Next. Problem 1 wären die freien Daten oder eben das Fehlen. Next. Das bedeutet erstens eine Abhängigkeit von den Datenanbietern. Deutsche Bahn ist da jetzt eine der ganz zentralen. Es bedeutet intransparent, es bedeutet auch eine Monopolbildung, weil die bestehenden Anbieter eben die Daten unter Kontrolle haben und damit keine freien Routing-Systeme möglich sind. Und es bedeutet natürlich auch Login-Effekte, wenn man abhängig wird. Next. Lösung ist Open Data. Next. Man kann Fahrplandaten, Live-Daten, Unfalldaten, Verkehrsströme und vieles mehr veröffentlichen. Next. Das bedeutet, man kann zum Beispiel intermodales Live-Routing machen, sodass man verschiedene Systeme zusammen zu einer einzigen Route macht. Man kann auch weitere Daten, da ist zum Beispiel Wikimedia recht aktiv, dass sie alle Bücher in allen Büchereien haben und dann Routing-Systeme dort mit anschließt, sodass man dann eben eine Route mitbekommt. Man kann eine transparente, offene Verkehrsplanung machen und natürlich irgendwo Anlagenmanagementsysteme. Next. Autonome Fahrzeuge werden dort noch einen besonderen Spaß geben, weil die natürlich noch viel mehr auf Daten, öffentliche Daten zurückgreifen müssen, private Daten aber dabei schützen müssen. Die EU spielt dort auch noch mit und Klimaschutz sorgt dafür, dass wir effizientere Systeme brauchen. Next. Zweites Problem, Datenschutz. Next. Einfach, flexibel und schnell, das sind so die Schlagworte. Next. Andere Leute hierzulande, zum Beispiel hier auf diesem Kongress, hört man aus solchen Systemen eher FID-Tracking und Sicherheitslücken. Next. Insbesondere da, wie bei Smart Mietern auch, das bislang kaum beachtet wird, dass es eventuell dort Sicherheitslücken oder IT-Probleme geben könnte. Datenschutz ist da eher ein Randthema. Es wird sehr auf Funktionen geachtet und die Sicherheitskonzepte sind extrem naiv. Next. Die üblichen Sachen, die man bei Datenschutz machen kann, sind natürlich hier herausfordernd. Next. Es erinnert sehr an Smart Meter und die ganzen Probleme. Dazu gibt es noch einen längeren Vortrag heute Abend, den ich sehr empfehlen würde, weil dort eine ganze Menge an unserer Infrastruktur gruselig schief geht. Next. Den Grundsatz, den sollte man vielleicht auch dort beachten oder gerade dort beachten, weil Verkehrsinfrastruktur nun mal eine der wichtigsten Dinge ist, sonst wären wir nicht alle hier. Next. Ja, was nun? Next. Einmischen? Auf jeden Fall. Next. Das bedeutet einerseits, die offenen Daten zu nutzen und auch zu fordern, aber auch das auf der anderen Seite, es werden jetzt in der nächsten Zeit eine ganze Menge Systeme auf den Markt kommen, die solche intermodalen Konzepte haben. Und diese sollten natürlich von Fachmenschen wie euch getestet werden. Was bedeutet, weil von sich aus wird dort nicht. Ein klassisches ÖPNV-Unternehmen ist nun mal nicht mit allzu vielen Sicherheitsexperten ausgestattet, für gewöhnlich. Dann natürlich Initiativen zu vernetzen. Ich bin selber in einer, Romobil e.V. steht auch auf dem Link gleich am Ende. Politik und Unternehmen informieren und natürlich mit Datenquellen verhandeln. Next. Das sind meine Kontaktdaten. Vielen Dank. Ich glaube, es ist ein bisschen ein Randthema, aber nichtsdestotrotz ein sehr wichtiges, weil Transport eben wichtig ist. So, das war mein eigener Timer. Danke.
Wow, that was a record number of slides. All right, it is time for a 10-minute break, and we are just a little bit behind schedule, so we will see you back here at 14:05, just to clear it up. 14:05, see you back here. Thank you.
chance that you might love me too. You give your hand to me, and then you say goodbye. I watch you walk away beside the lucky guy. Oh, you never know the one who loves you so. You don't know me. You never know the one who loves you so.
It's hard to say that I
Check, check. All right, welcome back, everybody, to the second part of today's lightning rounds. Don't forget, tomorrow we have the special Pecha Kucha round, and that is 20 slides, 20 seconds each, and they automatically advance. And that's a really fun round, so if you'd like to give a presentation, that's the best way to get in. Also, on day four, we have special 15-minute lightning talks. Those are all full right now, but we still have plenty of five-minute slots available, a couple for day three tomorrow, and the last day we have five-minute slots. To register, all you need to do is go to the wiki, and all of the directions are on there. So we still have plenty of slots open if you'd like to give a lightning talk. I think we're all full up for today because we're running a little bit behind schedule. So without any further ado, are you ready to go?
Sure.
Okay, and your 5 minutes, as soon as I get everything ready, your 5 minutes starts. Oh, Twitter, hold on, let me check that real quick. Okay, oh, never mind. Okay, your 5 minutes starts now.
Okay, hi. I want to tell you about why it would be quite interesting to establish the internet as an international space. And it would be in very good company up there, right with Antarctica, the high seas, and space. Deep space, I mean. Now, slide, please. Now, this is a representation of the infrastructure layer of the internet. It's not quite... It's a sort of stylized graphics, and you see the white lines, and those are the high traffic cables. And you see here there is quite an unfair distribution. You have the richest country and the countries that at night use the most energy, also the countries that have the best internet connection. Surprisingly, that's Europe and the U.S. What we see here is that the internet is a global phenomenon, is an international space, and these international spaces do have some nice qualities that have been laid out in treaties that have already been signed. So if we could establish the internet as an international space, we could just get into this protection without having to deal with all these nice little interest groups who meet in Arab countries trying to push their agenda. So we're looking into that, and we think that's quite an interesting project. Next slide, please. Now, I just give you the highlights, and it's really nice that these treaties say, they all say that these areas should be used for peaceful purposes, no commercial exploitation, freedom of scientific investigation, free exchange of information, sounds very familiar, no? And free and neutral access to installations and equipment. Also quite a good point that is already pointed out and has been discussed upon by diplomats and signed by the countries. Now, next slide, please. If we can get people to... if we can get the internet the protection that other international spaces have, we can do a nice policy hack, because we could say you already signed all these nice little protections and we don't have to negotiate them anew. That's quite important, and that's a feature or a bug of a diplomatic language. Because when you're discussing something and finally gets countries to sign, diplomats, state departments are very, very unwilling to change this language. That's a diplomatic language. That's agreed upon language, agreed upon interpretation, and they will never, ever get to all this process of getting all the people together, discussing it, all these dealings and back dealings and whatever, to get this treaty in a language that everybody agrees upon and then sign it. Now, next slide, please. I need people which are willing to participate in the project, because what do we need to do to establish the internet as an international space? We need to prove in scientific case studies that there are similarities between these spaces. Now, one very obvious similarity is that it's not a geographic location, not really, if you see it, look at space, where there is one country that has all these territorial rights that states normally have, but it's an area you enter and you decide, like on the high seas, when you put up the flag of your country, your ship is under that jurisdiction, meaning you choose which jurisdiction you're under.
1 minute.
Which is quite a great feature because you can choose the best jurisdiction, let's say, for your server. And therefore, I would just ask people to get in contact with me if they want to participate in the project. And I hope I could get you to participate. Thank you very much.
All good?
That's not my...
Oh, whoops. which presentation?
Fotoku.
Oh, you're up at 14. You're up. Yep. Oh, your time's up. No, just kidding. Actually, you're up after Y-Tech. Is Y-Tech here? Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. I apologize about that. Yeah, we are running a little bit behind. We're running actually two presentations behind right now, which is fine. So up next, Y-Tech, this is your presentation. And then Sam the techie. Sam, you were here?
Yeah.
Okay, Sam's over there. And then it's Fotoku. So, yep, we're running 10 minutes behind. I apologize for that. So without any further ado, you ready to go, Y-Tech?
Yeah, can you move back to the first slide? Yeah, great.
Okay, sorry about that. Okay, your 5 minutes starts now.
Great. Okay, I'm not even going to try to get all the things I'd like to get in, so I would like initially to invite anybody who'd like to talk about this at any point to get in touch. I'm just going to give some really, really brief idea of what we've been doing in trying to establish a GSM station in the indigenous community in Mexico. Next slide, please. So there's three kind of axes here. The technology part, which we have the technology, software-defined radios, and the open source stuff that were sometimes not quite so open. But it's possible to do it now on an economic level that wasn't possible a few years ago. But the other part of this, or the second part of this, which is really important, is the community level. The indigenous communities in Mexico often have some pretty strong traditional administration structures, if you like, that these are ancient civilizations. They've been there for a pretty long time. And they don't necessarily recognize the authority of the relatively recently arrived Europeans and the federal government. One of the ideas that's really strong in the indigenous communities in Mexico is like the responsibility for the land, you know, the where they live on the land, they use the air, the spectrum, if you like, and so they have responsibility for that. And not some absent federal government or business interest. So don't underestimate that. Action is taken on this basis, and these communities really do run their own show. Yeah. Okay, so the next thing is the legal part of it. If you really want to set up a GSM base station, you have to try to get a license, you have to try to get permission to use a frequency. It's a pretty serious crime not to do so. So the concessions that are granted to the major operators state that they should provide universal service. But they don't, and they've shown themselves unwilling to do so when they're asked to, according to our research. Right? Their business model doesn't really permit it. It's not really about service, it's about profit. So they're not going to put in base stations where it's a loss-making operation. Now, among the people who are responsible for licensing and regulation and that in Mexico, there's an element in there that is really interested in having micro-operators work, but their hands are not necessarily untied in that respect, right? but they are interested in facilitating it, and you know, establishing the conditions where micro operators could move in where the big MNOs won't go. Can we just move on to the next slide there very quickly? We can go through these. These are just some pictures that I wanted to show you of what we've been doing. That's the next one, please. These are just people seeing mobile phone signal in their community for the first time. Next one, please. It's showing it's showing people how it works. And the next one. It's just a meeting where we spoke to the local presidents and explained how it would work, and they've agreed to enter into the legal battle with us, to get permission to do this. And that's the last one, isn't it? And we go back to we put up the details, contact details. And I'll just sum up very quickly. The idea is if nobody else is using the spectrum, why can't we use it? And if somebody's saying we can't use it, then who's saying we can't use it? And why are they saying that? And what's their weakness? So that's what we're doing. We're looking, what's the weakness? And we're moving in from that point of view to take a legal challenge based on the idea that the indigenous communities have the right to run their own affairs, which they do, actually. It's guaranteed in the Constitution. That's what we're at. Once again, if anybody's interested in talking about that, please get in touch. There's details there. And thank you very much.
Okay, Sam, you are up next. And then Fotoku. After Fotoku, we have SM Render. Are you in the present? The SM Render presentation? Okay, awesome. Right there. And then GNUNet, Christian? Okay, cool. Eleanor, are you here? Oh, okay, great. Eleanor is back there. And Tobias, Open Tech School? Okay, well, hopefully they will be here by 14:45. So Sam, you just had one background graphic, is that correct? Good? Okay, and your 5 minutes starts now.
Hey everyone, I'm Sam the Techie, or Samuel Carlisle, from London Hackspace. It's a sincere pleasure to be here at Congress, my first Congress, and that's not mine. Alt tab, please, thank you. Okay, yes, so Suki is essentially, it's a web app, which is not those things.
That's I'm going to stop the clock because it wants Thank to you. Go back into...
Wrong file. It's the wrong file.
No, it's not. It keeps wanting to go into slideshow mode instead of full screen because I hit F5 instead of F11. Yes. Okay, so now we're good. I'll reset your clock and hopefully it won't move. Go.
Hi, I'm Sam the Techie. I'm Samuel Carlisle, coming from London Hackspace. It's my first time at Congress. It's a sincere pleasure to be here. I intend on visiting many more hackerspaces while I'm in Europe, so I'd like invitations to those, please. I've come to give you a quick talk about Suki, which is something I'm the co-founder of. It's essentially an app to keep people safe, mobile, and informed, demos. And the history of the app is basically coming from a student movement in London called the UCL Occupation. We basically needed some means of aggregating information about what was going on at a demonstration and trying to make sense of it to pass it back to people who are actually on the ground. And so we were occupying a university there. Since then, we've kind of actually evolved the idea a bit to being, to focus on the problem, how do we take the contributions from 10,000 people who are on the ground at a demo, maybe sending updates by Twitter or Instagram or Flickr, or just generally trying to make sensory observations while they're actually on at an event. How do we process all that information in real time, fact check, and verify that in such a way that we can pass it back to the crowd in a meaningful way? This is a huge kind of choreographic task of collaboration. And so Suki's kind of there to be this organizing or kind of curating volunteer task force to effectively digest and understand all the data coming out of an event. And we do that by, it's pretty simple actually, we aggregate data from services like Twitter and Instagram, and we actually we have little bots running to pull those into an IRC channel or a Jabber server. And we have groups of volunteers actually standing by in that channel. So there are some of them are subject matter experts, some of them are just journalists who are very, very good at cross-checking and fact-checking to try and work out, get some veracity, get some understanding about how truthful the information that's coming from the social network is. then they can effectively discuss or contrast this information against what else they can find online. And then they can send out a stream of updates by Twitter or actually through the app itself. We also publish data onto maps that you can get from within the app to give you real-time situational awareness about what's actually going on. We've deployed in London, and we deployed also in New York for May Day. So the one thing I didn't say is I'm an activist, also coming from Occupy London, and I was part of the tech team there. And you know, civic media and empowerment is something that's like fundamentally important to me in how I relate to technology and what I'm doing as an electronic engineer, just in life as a hacker. I see technology has a really key role to play to actually empower social movements. So, living on the street essentially in Occupy London for 8 months and just kind of, get Wi-Fi together in really crazy situations, just to kind of provide a platform for the people to be able to use the technology. And I also came to Occupy Frankfurt and the occupation in Geneva to help out as well. Mostly there to just kind of, literally make the internet work and try and empower the people of the movement. So I have really big ambitions for Suki in the next coming year. We have a really great team together, some lovely, lovely people from Canada, actually based in DC, and some lovely people back in London and some other cities who are really helping to make Suki be able to be deployed in more countries. We don't want to make the same mistake that have been made by other projects where, we're not quite ready with the tech, and then we kind of go to a really challenging environment where people's lives could be at risk by using such a platform. So we want to kind of get as much help as possible, because we think it's a really key intervention to be able to basically aggregate lots of data, fact check and verify, and then be able to push this data back out again. And I must also state that we're just a middleman for information, as it were. We don't intend to be a command and control platform. And as the founder, as the co-founder of Suki, I would never let it be used in that way. And this is actually built into the way the app is run. So I actually want help from any experts who can help us design a platform to be robust and to kind of prevent the kind of hijack that might go on. As you know, from different social movements that are using online platforms, they're changing their leadership all the time and trying to recycle the roles. And we want to be compatible with that kind of ethos as well. I'd also give a little plug to movements like Crypto Party, the Maker Movement, of course, the Hackerspace Movement, the Hacker Movement, and the Occupy Movement, just to say that, all of these are very, very integral and very important to kind of where we're heading as a society. And I think that, your participation...
30 seconds.
Your participation in these movements is actually really changing things. And I would actually strongly advocate that if you don't know about a local Crypto Party movement or a local indie media news group or something, that you just kind of like look to see if you can get involved, because they'd really want to hear from you as an engineer, as a tech person, or actually wherever you're coming from, if you think you can help them. So, cheer. Hey. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
Okay, now you're ready to go. Sorry about that confusion earlier. We are running 10 minutes behind, but I think we should be able to get through everything. Still have plenty of slots open for day 3 and 4. And so without any further ado, you good? Everything's good? All right.
Okay, hi there. I'm going to do this talk in German because our project is mainly limited within the German boundaries. People who want to get more information in English can come to our workshop later, which I will show in my slides. So, okay, worum geht's bei Fotoku? Es geht um eine Suche nach einer progressiven, nicht kommerziellen Fotoagentur, die einen gewissen politischen Anspruch versucht in den Bildern auszudrücken. Und das gibt es unserer Meinung nach noch nicht. Diese Bilder gibt es durchaus, aber sie können nicht gefunden werden. Weil im Bereich des politischen Layouts einige Freunde von mir, die es halt häufig machen, sagen, das ist einfach eine unglaublich zeitaufwendige Arbeit, diese Bilder zu finden, obwohl sie halt, wie gesagt, durchaus vorhanden sind. Slide. Und wir wollen versuchen, politisches und nicht kommerzielle Medienproduktion zu vereinfachen und dazu, Slide, please. Und dazu die Sichtbarkeit von sozial motivierter Fotografie, also Fotografie mit einem gesellschaftlichen Anspruch zu erhöhen und den fotografierenden Menschen eine Möglichkeit zur Selbstdarstellung zu geben und dabei halt dieses Spezialwissen, was man dafür braucht für diese Selbstdarstellung, dieses Wissen zu teilen. Und dadurch, dass halt die Leute, die gut Fotos machen können, können sich weiterhin aufs Foto machen konzentrieren. Und die Leute, die halt gerne Webplattformen bauen oder an Suchoptimierung arbeiten, machen halt dies in dieser Arbeitsteilung. Slide, please. Und das ist auch ein ganz wichtiger Punkt. Wir glauben, jede Bewegung hat ihre eigenen Bilder, die unglaublich konstituierend sind für wichtige Momente. Aber der Punkt ist, Slide please, wo sind diese Bilder heute? Diese Bilder landen bei der Deutschen Presseagentur oder sie sind kaum zu finden, weil sie über irgendwelche Umwege also nicht direkt recherchierbar sind. Und was auch ganz wichtig ist, dass meistens die Menschen, die diese Bilder gemacht haben, oft in den Hintergrund treten. Also sie verschwinden hinter ihren eigenen Bildern, weil gerade bei Presseagenturen es oft das Problem ist, dass sie einfach diese kompletten Alleinvertretungsverträge halt ihre Rechte alle abtreten müssen. Slide. Und das sind halt zentrale Aspekte des Projektes. Die Lizenz, von der wir glauben, dass sie alle unsere Probleme löst, wollen wir gerne noch diskutieren mit Leuten hier auf dem Kongress. Wir müssen noch diskutieren, wie inhaltlich die Auswahl der Bilder getroffen werden können. Und bei den Retrieval Features geht es uns vor allen Dingen darum, halt verschiedene Ansprüche zu kombinieren. Slide, please. Und es geht also im Kern darum, die Zugänglichkeit von FlickAir und die Masse von FlickAir zusammen mit der Technologie von Getty Images zu verbinden, den politischen Inhalt vom Umbruch Bildarchiv darzustellen und das möglicherweise mit der Geschwindigkeit von Twitter. Also das bringt es quasi so ein bisschen auf den Punkt, was unsere Pläne sind. Slide, please. Und dafür suchen wir halt Leute, die ihre Erfahrungen in Webprojekten mit uns teilen wollen, die uns in Medienrecht beraten wollen, gerade was diese Lizenz angeht. Wir suchen Leute, die Lust haben, Buchhaltung für einen guten Zweck zu machen, die gerne mit Interface-Design spielen, die vielleicht unsere Plattform auch aus der Uploaderin-Perspektive nutzen wollen, also sprich Fotografen und Fotografinnen, oder die vielleicht auch Geld für uns besorgen wollen, für unser Projekt. Und das Ganze wollen wir halt ausführlicher im Workshop tun. Slide. Der heute Abend um 6 stattfinden wird in Hall 13, also Halle 13. Genau, und da gibt es für euch die Möglichkeit, mit uns quasi
One minute.
Einfluss auf die ganzen Dinge zu üben. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, SM Render is up next. And just as a reminder, I'd like to try one thing real quick. I think we were a little bit loud with the countdown, just in case. Hopefully we won't need it, but let's try practicing a countdown where we go from 10, 9, and then gradually build up. Is that okay? All right, so let's just try it so it's not to be too disruptive, so. Okay, excellent, great. So you've still got 5 minutes, don't worry. And your clock starts your clock starts now.
Okay, hello everybody. My name is Bernhard Fischer. I'm contributor to several open source projects. I'm a member of the Cypherpunk, of the Austrian Cypherpunk Assembly, and I'm lecturer at the St. Berg University of Applied Sciences in Austria. And I'd like to briefly introduce SMRender, a rule-based rendering engine for OSM data. Next. I give you one single sentence. It is like a programming language which is suitable to process OSM data. And this is simply like SED is to process text files. Next slide. Okay, what it is not just a renderer. It is a programmable OSM processing engine. It is written in C. It comes with a set of built-in functions. And it is really modular, so you can easily attach your own functions to it. Next. It is originally, the original development goals have been rendering of charts suitable for printout, but it's much more today. It was developed with the goal of execution efficiency in terms of memory and CPU power. And it has a set of very flexible match operations on the data. Next. Here we have a brief outline of how it works. You fill in OSM data, you fill in the rule set. The rule set actually is the program. Probably you have optional data like icons or whatever, and then you fill it into SMRender, and it will produce something according to your program, some kind of output like PNG files, CAP files, tiles, OSM data, or whatever you like. Okay, next. The rule set is actually the program you write. It is written in OSM format as well. So if you're familiar with OSM, you will easily come into how to write this program. You have nodes, ways, relations, all that stuff. Each object consists of a set of match operations you can apply to the tags of each object. And then you have one action to be carried out, which is actually the function that is applied to this object. Next. Just to give you an overview on the conditions, the match operations, it's string compare, regular expressions, and then I can do value comparison, not just string operations, so it interprets the values, if it is numeric, of course, and some kind of inversion and exclusion, so logic operations. Next. Yes, a set of built-in functions is there, so I can do draw captions, filling, placing images, generating output, and a lot more. But as I said, you can attach your own functions. Next. Yes, so I'd like to invite everybody to my workshop at 4 p.m. today in our assembly in floor 1B. There I will show how to write own functions for it. And you will find everything in Google. Just type my name or just type SMRender and you find all contact information. Thank you.
All right, you good? Time starts now.
Hi, everyone. I wanted to briefly discuss a little bit about what we're doing in the GNUNet project. My name is Christian Grotov. Next slide. You might know GNUNet as a file-sharing network, which is what we started out with in 2001. And yeah, that might not be wrong because we do anonymous file-sharing. We have a lot of privacy features, so when you search, your queries are encrypted, the replies come through the network encrypted. Intermediaries can verify that the replies match the queries but can't decrypt them, can search in various ways. We have all the usual features you might want in a file-sharing system, like migration, replication, swarming. Have an economy to reward people who share, but we have done a lot more since our beginnings, and I wanted to give you a brief idea of what we've been doing. So first off, we've been building up some infrastructure. Next slide. So the most important infrastructure for us is the distributed hash table, and we've built the R5N distributed hash table to be a censorship-resistant hash table that works in a restricted route topology, which means that your peers cannot be expected to talk to all other peers at all times because we have things like NAT and other evil devices on the internet that prevent communication. And the graphic basically shows our success rate in a hostile environment compared to Kademlia at the bottom over a number of rounds. So the DHT is randomized, so as you try again, you have an increasing chance of succeeding eventually. Next slide. Also, as we are in a hostile environment to peer-to-peer networks in general, we wanted to avoid being blocked by ISPs. So last year, Matthias presented to you our basic idea that we can run GNUNet over all kinds of protocols. This year, I'm happy to announce it now also works over HTTPS with reverse proxy. So if you go to gnu.org/speedtest, that's a peer, not a website. The only thing is you might get a 404 because your browser doesn't speak GNUNet. So we hope this way people who are afraid to run a peer might be more willing to do so, and people who might be blocked because their ISP thinks that everything except for HTTP and HTTPS is evil can still access the network as well. Because, well, it will just be HTTP over TLS. Next, please. Another problem we had to solve was NAT traversal. So most existing NAT traversal technologies effectively assume that you have some third party that will help you traverse the NAT box. We were the first P2P network to implement the following idea. Your peer sends out an ICMP packet to a non-existing, non-routable IP address, say 1234, which obviously goes nowhere. And then some other peer who wants to contact you behind that NAT box effectively sends back a faked ICMP response saying, I'm a router, I had to drop your packet.
your NAT will think, oh, that's a response to this packet that was lost, and passes to your peer. Your peer gets this packet and says, oh, this guy wants to contact me. Let me establish an outgoing connection to him. So we can do NAT traversal without a third party. Next. Now, as we want to go for world domination, we wanted to make sure that our system works at a large scale. So we've been building some infrastructure to emulate large peer-to-peer networks. So if you're interested in protocol research, our system has been able to run about 80,000 peers in a small cluster, not this one. That's our next target, where we want to go for the million peer mark, so we can be sure that everything scales. Next. Other applications are then file sharing. We've talked about earlier about the DNS replacement for censorship-resistant name resolution. One other thing we have done is being able to run IP traffic over the GNUnet peer-to-peer network. So, you know, if you really still need IP, seems a bit necessary sometimes, you can use the GNUnet peer-to-peer network for that.
1 minute.
And we can use the peer-to-peer network to do also IPv4 to IPv6 protocol translation for you, have effectively DNS application level gateway, so you can use it as a transition mechanism or offer services within the peer-to-peer network that are not visible on the internet. Next. Yeah, just want to say we just got started. We've got lots of other features implemented or planned. You can find about them on our website or talk to us at the P2P Hackerspace. Next. And yeah. That's it.
Okay, and we have, I think, three more talks left today. We've got Eleanor, and then I just spoke with Tobias, and Alex, paranormal psychology. Are you in the room, Alex?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, great, awesome. Okay, sweet. So all of our presenters are here, and Eleanor, are you ready to go?
Yep.
Okay, your 5 minutes starts now.
Hi, my name is Eleanor Saeta. I'm principal security engineer at the Open Internet Tools Project, among a lot of other hats. So I want to talk to you about a new project which we're starting up, which is the OpenIT Peer Review Board. One of the problems that we have right now is there's a lot of people in hostile regions who are using software, whether it's for disk encryption or communication or unlinkability or censorship resistance, and their lives actually depend on that software working and working the way it's supposed to work. But none of that software has been audited, for the most part. I mean, there are a few exceptions. You know, OpenSSH has seen audits. OpenSSL has seen audits. Let's talk about Pigeon. Pigeon is a great piece of software that's used as a malware target for malware writing courses, and we also recommend it to people who are running it in hostile regions. This is kind of a problem. There's probably a pile of dead bodies associated with some of the bugs in that particular piece of software. Part of this comes back down to basically professionalization. You know, the community that is writing tools that are designed to be used in hostile regions for a long time has been kind of people who are interested in the subject or care. Caring is great. Caring is not actually enough. We need to start being a professional about the way we do this stuff. So the project of the peer review board is intended to raise the bar on kind of what the standard is for software that's deployed in hostile regions, for software that's intended to guarantee freedom of expression and media freedom. There will be a kind of a two-stage acceptance process where there's a first round of kind of initial qualifications for what you need to be as far as impact, open source status, documentation, et cetera. If a project meets those criteria, there'll be an initial set of evaluation, a further set of evaluation criteria for like, okay, is this threat model that you have good enough, et cetera. And then OpenITP, through donors, will be sponsoring commercial audits. So the idea is to take these pieces of software that we're depending on, actually tear them apart properly, and then get the bugs fixed. There's a lot of moving parts that go into a system like this, as far as how things like full disclosure are handled, where the audit results go, how transparency is handled, because obviously a project like this must be fully transparent, but we have to balance that with when things become published for making sure that we're not just dropping zero day on activists. a lot of the stuff will be documented. All the stuff eventually will be documented. The goal is to not just start one project, but to start a pattern for projects that can be replicated elsewhere. If you go to wiki.openitp.org, you can find more information about where the project is right now, or feel free to send me email or talk to me on Twitter if you're interested in finding out more. One of the we are still looking for funding for some of the work. The basic board is funded, and we have money for the first set of audits, but we're still looking for further funding. If you happen to, say, work for a company that is interested in giving back to the community and cares about security and freedom of expression, we'd be very interested in talking.
And we have a quick slide update. This was the deck that you were looking for?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Wow, we're catching up. So are you ready to go? Okay, just a couple of quick reminders. We do have some Lightning Talk slots open for tomorrow and for day four as well. We've got the Pecha Kucha round coming up tomorrow and 15-minute talks on the first part of day four. And I think that's about it. Be sure to also take all trash and bottles with you when you leave so that we don't get that familiar sound, which we fortunately no longer hear in Sol 1. But without any further ado, 5 minutes starts now.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Tobias, and I'm just for today the messenger for Open Tech School, which is about education and next. So the question is, what is Open Tech School? It's basically a small non-profit organization that organizes workshops, tech-related. Next. And it's about openness, so all the discussion that happens is freely available on Google Groups nowadays. We have training material prepared, there are blueprints, and everybody is sharing the skills and time for free. And but you're also welcome to participate and share your achievements and become a coach yourself. And next. So it's also about empowerment, so it doesn't depend which skill level or which experience you have. It's you to being part of it as a teacher or as a coach, and you can have your workshops your own. And we really want you to be part of that and learn how rewarding teaching is. And what we provide is basically the framework for all of this to organize a workshop and to create your own community to make an initiative yourself. Next. So we have did workshops, and those are with small groups of three or four people, and there's a coach with those people so they can continue on their own progress. And they have their own aims, but there's also a roadmap prepared, so you can stick on certain problems, but you can still work on your own stuff. Next. It's quite important that you provide a safe and comfy environment so people can learn at their own speed. And we also encourage people to share their experience and share their goals. And so in the end, everybody presents what he or she did. And that's important, so everybody loses the fear to speak in front of people. Next. We encourage everybody here to create her or his own project. We did that in Stockholm, and it's now coming up in Melbourne. It started in Berlin. So please do your own. Next. It's all non-profit. As I said, the material is available online on the webpage, but also on GitHub. We have the website is online, and all the material for talks and workshop that already happened. And we have quite a lot of topics. Next. So we did JavaScript for beginners. Next. There are some some pictures next. And we did Python. There's a friend over there who did the Python workshop. Next. And we did a Git workshop just in, November? And there will be another one very soon. Next. And quite regularly, we have beginner workshops. That's something where really non-techie people get to into something like JavaScript and get basic knowledge of something and just test it out their own. Next.
1 minute.
Thank you. Next. And that started also on the campus party you may have heard of. That was last year, a bigger event in Berlin. Next. Where we had about 30 workshops, really small, but people passed by and just enjoyed. Next.
30 seconds.
Next. So we have upcoming workshops, as I said, but this is also to get you into this. Next. So you can teach or learn, depends on you. Next. And get in touch. I will be upstairs and at 15 o'clock, there's a big blue banner right there. And if you want to get in touch, meet me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Alex, with our final presentation of the day. And for this image, I'm going to be sure to hit F11, not F5, because clearly I did not have enough coffee today either. Did we need some assistance getting up?
Vielleicht hier direkt.
Check.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Ich bin da.
Okay, danke.
Huge round of applause for Watts and the last minute helper.
Okay, hello. My subject is a bit unusual for a hacker conference, but I think there are links between the two topics I wanted to discuss, and that's why I'm here. My subject is why you have to be a hacker to investigate the paranormal. I have offered counseling for people who have experiences which they perceive as paranormal for the last 13 years, like seeing something which they interpret as a ghost or something like that. And the problem is that people with these experiences are often not taken seriously. They are said to be insane or mentally ill, and that's very often not the case. A lot of these experiences can be explained by conventional, normal, physical, neurological, or psychological, or even a combination of these factors. And I want to present three cases which are interesting because the reason why the person had this experience wasn't easy to find, and that's my theory that you have need hacker skills to investigate these cases, because a hacker for me is somebody who likes to take a deeper look at things, likes to do unusual things with technology, and think in unusual ways. And that's why I think you need these skills. The first case was a woman who suddenly heard voices. The interesting thing was she only heard these voices when she listened to a music cassette with Russian music. Somebody advised her to see a psychiatrist, and this psychiatrist gave her neuroleptica, and it didn't work. She still heard this voice, these voices. So she asked a physicist, and this guy had a deeper look at it, took the cassette, listened to it, and heard voices. What happened? The tape inside was turned around, went backwards, and created the illusion of hearing voices. And that's why a woman was treated with neuroleptica. I think that's... that shouldn't happen. The second case was a man who heard radio in his kitchen without having a radio, and or heard voices. And the same physicist came to him and found out that just a moment. That the tea plate. The tea kettle on the hot plate was acting as a receiver for a radio transmitter mast near the man's home, and that's why he heard voices in his teapot. Some other person would have said to him as well, go to a psychiatrist and take some medicine, or go to a hospital for the mentally ill, and that shouldn't happen. Third case was a man sitting in his office and suddenly seeing a figure which looked like a ghost, and this man didn't believe in ghosts.
1 minute.
Okay. And took a deeper look at it, and found out that he always saw this figure when the ventilator was on. And the ventilator created an infrasound, which is not hearable for people, just a moment. Need the word. An infrasound vibrating synchronously to the eyeball, and that's that created the hallucination of a
30
figure.
Seconds.
And. There have been many cases of people who claim to see ghosts at castles, which where the wind is going through tunnels, and that's creating an infrasound too. And these people are not mentally ill; they don't need treatment. They just have this neurological effect. Okay, thank you. If you want to contact me, I'm around here.
Thank you very much. We will see you back here tomorrow and on day 4 for more lightning talks. Thank you.